G20 summit is up and running.
A lot of the attention at this meeting is going to be focused not on the big group meeting, but on things that happen on the sideline, bilateral meetings between President Trump and Vladimir Putin of Russia.
They're saying that Putin is going to eat Trump's lunch.
You know, when you describe that room with President Trump and Secretary Tillerson and Lavrov and Putin, you know, I think one thing that we can get from that is we have a really strong team sitting across the table.
We are sitting on massive energy, and we are now exporters of energy. So whenever you need energy, just give us a call.
The Russian economy is heavily dependent on hydrocarbon exports.
Let me be very clear about one crucial point. The United States will never use energy to coerce your nations, and we cannot allow others to do so. You don't want to have a monopoly or a monopolistic situation.
Energy and money, it seems that they always are connected somehow with power.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, it's been another good week for stock investors, with most major indexes in positive territory. About the only one in negative territory this week was the utility average, but all markets in positive territory. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Dan Wobtrowski will join me from Janie Montgomery Scott in the first hour. He said the FANG stocks are coming under pressure, and the mid-caps have been having some of a bit of a tough year. This has been a large cap driven market since the beginning of the year. That's where you made money. But Dan sees sector rotation occurring. You're going to want to hear about that, and also what he thinks will be catalysts for the markets going forward in the year ahead. And if you've wondered why the dollar has gone down, why the Fed has been raising interest rates, Mark Chandler from Brown Brothers Harriman will be joining me as we talk about why the dollar is down, why gold is not done as well, given a falling dollar, and what is causing other currencies to rise against the dollar. That coming up in hour one, and Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week.
And I'm John Loeffler. Next week, Fed Chair Janet Yellen is going to be on Capitol Hill for testimony, and the markets will be focusing on whether or not the Fed is consistent on what they plan on doing as far as interest rates and their balance sheet are concerned. You know, the market has gone up for 9 years consistently, and it has been driven almost exclusively by central bank policy, not by economic fundamentals or other things which have pushed markets up in the past. And the Fed is now signaling that's all over. So the question is, if we're out on the dance floor, should we be slowly sliding toward the side in order to make it out the exit before something goes into a downturn? As a matter of fact, speaking of predictions, which the Fed almost always gets wrong, you have to wonder about that. Their models seem flawed. But this year is turning out much differently than expected. Oil was expected to go up due to OPEC cuts. It's actually come down. Rates, which were expected to rise, have fallen. The dollar was expected to rise against other currencies, but bleep, it's fallen as well. And nothing has turned out so far the way it was predicted, but the stock market's been doing great. So does that mean it's still party time? Or what kind of an environment are we operating in here? All of that will be subject of intense, meaningful conversation coming up in the big picture in the second hour here today on the Financial Sense News Hour. So first of all, in the program, welcome back Ryan Poplava to discuss this week's wrap-up report. And Ryan, what would you tell us about the short week we had on Wall Street this week due to the holiday weekend? It's the first week of July, so I'm going to guess we could expect a lot of economic data, with the big one being the jobs report that came out right at the end of the week. That led to the week closing positive, if I'm not mistaken.
It did. And actually, it closed very strongly towards the end of the day on Friday, I think just carrying some of that momentum from the morning. And I guess just the sense that we never gave it up like we did on Monday. A lot of gains were given up from early in the morning. But yeah, you're right. Economists are calling the jobs results this week a Goldilocks report. That's the main item this week, as it showed solid growth without the inflationary concerns associated with full employment. We get full employment, typically hourly wages go up. That's still not happening yet. Hourly earnings were only up like 0.2%. And if wages aren't overheating, then that allows the Fed to continue to be very gradual in its approach towards tightening credit. So that enables the bulls to embolden their investments and long. So if there's no inflation, why did the treasury bonds fall, causing rates to go up? Well, it's because the growth was solid enough to justify the base case scenario of another hike this year. You know, we've been averaging, I forget the amount, but it's been in the low 200,000 additions every single month. That's the average here for the past 6 months, I think. And the rise in yields, it was very moderate, though. You know, it wasn't a huge big bump. It was only like 2 basis points to 2.39%. We finished last week at 2.3%-ish for the 10-year Treasury note. And Treasuries did correct more on Monday. That was the biggest move in Treasury notes, when we saw there was a very strong purchasing managers index data from Europe. You know, we get those numbers halfway through the month and at the very end of the month for Europe, US, and Japan, and only at the end of the month for China. China's was a little better than expected, and the US had a very good ISM manufacturing index survey, which was up, I think, 2.9 points in June, up to 57.8. So very strong manufacturing surveys and data. Some of it's hard data and some of it's soft data, but that definitely kicked off the rally early this week on Monday. Unfortunately, gave up some of those gains going into the end of the day on Monday.
But you know, Brian, conditions haven't been perfect. So I heard this week that auto sales continue to decelerate. So what's going on there?
You're right. And we've talked about it really on the side. It hasn't been a major story. And I definitely want to apologize to our listeners as I'm thinking about this right now, because it has been a trend that's been going on now for since December. Auto sales peaked at around 18.4 million units. And recently, looking at what has happened, it's gone down to around 16.5 in June. So that was one of the bad economic numbers that came out this week. Construction spending was also a disappointment. Factory orders were also down 1.1%. So definitely not everything is rosy. As you said, the conditions are not perfect. And some might even say that we're continuing to see some of this deceleration in specific pockets of the economy. In fact, I just heard from Chris Sheridan Friday that Andrew Zatlin, an economist that Chris interviewed on Insider, talked about his vice index. And his vice index is essentially something he's put together that models and surveys and understands and looks at discretionary spending, not just discretionary spending, but highly discretionary spending items. And he calls it his vice index because it's exactly that. He's measuring alcohol purchases, recreational drugs, gambling, and escort services. So I'm not sure how he's gathering all of his data, but he's getting it. And essentially, you know, he's got some really interesting things to say about that. Why don't we turn to some clips on that now?
Vice index has rolled over, and what we're seeing is it's crashed. Typically, this is 4 to 5 months leading for regular retail consumer spending. So if it's crashing now, it really implies that we're going to start seeing this show up in the broader economy roughly by September, October.
So there you have it. His vice index has been falling, and he also believes that that index is a very leading indicator on consumer spending, and consumer spending is a very large part of our economy, tends to lead the economy. So very interesting comments. It definitely, like you said, John, it's not a rosy situation right now, and could be essentially the shot across the bow. What's going on in auto sales, the disappointment there, and other areas are eventually going to be sensitive towards the Fed exiting its accommodative stance. Gradually, yes, but eventually rates will be too high. And too high is a relative term right now, because you have to relate just how far the Fed has tightened policy, not rates, but policy from when, you know, way back Bernanke first started to taper.
Yeah, because monetary policy just isn't measured by their Fed funds rate tool. I mean, they removed some of their accommodative policy when Bernanke tapered its bond purchase program. And remember, that started the process of tightening credit. So yeah, it seems like ancient history, to be honest with you.
So many years.
Yeah, so many years. Bernanke, who's he?
I know. It's weird. He does speeches now, I think.
Yeah, and they usually do that, and they get paid pretty well for that. Okay, Ryan, let me see. If the market is starting to get word that the reflation trade is back now, that investors are anticipating what the European Central Bank may do to taper its purchases based on ECB President Mario Draghi's comments last week, what do you see happening with the rest of the trade in financials, oil, gold, and then all of the rate-sensitive equities?
Gosh, John, you know, show me a trader that completely understands the technical and fundamentals of oil right now and can predict where prices will be in 6 months. Gosh, you know, let's dedicate a podcast for this guy or gal, and I'll raise mutual funds for somebody like that. But there are definitely some things that have been happening in that area. But definitely, I would like to focus on oil if we can right now, because there was definitely some information this week, some news, inventory data. We got Baker Hughes showed an increase of about 12 rigs when active, more than last week. And as we know, that trend is up each month. We continue to see rigs are going up in the U.S. Supply also, even though there was a dip last week, and that's why we got a small spike in oil. Data showed this week that production actually went up over the last week, about the same amount that went down last week, about 100,000 barrels per day. And while we did get bullish inventory data 2 weeks in a row where there was a draw on inventories on both gasoline and crude, and that came out of the American Petroleum Institute, we have seen some bearish information as well. And that goes towards a couple of stories I read this week talking about OPEC has produced 2 million more barrels per day in June versus last year, despite the cuts that they've made and the extension, obviously, which is going to go another, 6 or 9 months. And they expressed in this article mainly that a lot of this production has been due to Nigeria and Libya not being held to the same cut restrictions. So they've been ramping up production. We talked about that, I think, 2 weeks ago. But on the flip side, you know, I read on Friday that OPEC may be imposing cuts because, hey, allowing two countries to cheat and maybe a few are on the side are also cheating is allowing production, like I just said, able to go up and increase. And that is counterproductive to obviously what their message is to the markets, what they're trying to do in cutting back oversupply. And, you know, I also read another conflicting article this week, actually a couple of them on Russia. One on Tuesday said that Russia isn't on board with more cuts. And then I read one on Friday that said that they are, and that they're actually planning on meeting with other oil producing countries in Russia on July 24th. So, you know, you commodity traders, save that date. And with what's going on in oil, someone said that's part of the reflationary trade. My own impression is that, you know, things got very bearish on sentiment and positioning, and we're very oversold technically, and we're due a bounce, and we got that with a couple of key catalyst informations last week, like the slight cut in production, and that's what's going on there. Financials are definitely being helped by the steepening of the yield curve. We've been talking about this now for weeks, and that is definitely a situation that's very interesting, because the very day that tech sold off, this was like 3 weeks ago on Friday, I forget the specific date, but it was based on those Goldman Sachs analyst comments where we felt that the social networking companies, the big tech names, those fabulous five we've been talking about now for months, were getting a little overvalued, and that created this correction in tech. And where'd that money go? It didn't go into cash. It actually went into energy at the time and financials. And now, you know, we're looking at healthcare and financials as opposed to energy, where, you know, money and strength is flowing. And that's the real crux right now for anybody looking at stocks. It's where's leadership? Is it in the technology stocks, which have been just clobbered here in the last few weeks? Or is it now shifting to financials with the steepening of the yield curve? That could be the case, and definitely will be interesting to see the reaction by investors this earnings season, as that's quickly approaching next week, I think.
Well, let's see. Stocks, check. Bonds, commodity, check. Economics and monetary policy. I think we've covered all the main topics this week. Anything, as I always ask, we should have our radar focused on next week. By the way, how's the market doing in North Korean ICBMs? Market going up or what?
I have not been on the Bloomberg terminal looking for prices, but it hasn't affected the market yet. But I have been reading research that many strategists do believe that it was a tail risk. When you look at a bell-shaped curve, the probability of this happening, we call the sides the tails, very low probability. But they said that those probabilities now are widening on issues with North Korea, conflict, with the U.S. versus them. I read a couple articles about U.S. bomber planes flying over the South China Sea, ships doing exercises with Japanese near the same, like 12 miles off of some Chinese island, one of their artificial islands that they've created. And this is out there. It's definitely a risk. And is that priced into oil? No. That's not priced into gold, but it's a tail risk. Again, those probabilities are really low right now, but like I said, a lot of strategists are increasing that.
Well, it should be interesting. In this increased evidence, we know what happened to Amelia Earhart, but I guess that's a subject for a different day. Same part of the world, though, so we'll let it go at that. Okay, appreciate it, Ryan Poplava. We'll check in with you again next week. It's been a real interesting year, you must admit that.
Definitely. And it's going to continue to do that. It surprised me every single week.
Okay. Thank you, Ron. Appreciate it.
We'll talk to you next week.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
The very idea that markets work perfectly and frictionlessly defies the fact of human biology. The notion of market efficiency, while it's still an incredibly important concept and very relevant for investors today, we have to recognize that in certain cases, markets have different degrees of efficiency. In some cases, markets may be incredibly efficient. Typically, when you've got lots of investors that are highly competitive and engaged in various kinds of information gathering activities. But in other cases where the wisdom of crowds is replaced by the madness of mobs, when we are all acting in the same emotional way, we get a very inefficient market. And this idea of going from efficiency to inefficiency, it's really through adaptation. It's evolution at the speed of thought. And that's really the theme of adaptive markets.
Well, the stock market has been going sideways here over the last 2 weeks, not doing much of anything as we end Q1 last Friday, and we are now into the third quarter in corporate earnings season. Joining me on the program is Dan Wotropski. He's Director of Research at Janney Montgomery Scott. And Dan, let's begin with the S&P 500 sort of going sideways here, not doing much of anything. It looks like it's either taking a little digestion period and waiting for some kind of catalyst, or is there something else going on here?
Something more sinister. Hey, Jim, thanks for having us on. I don't think so. I mean, year-over-year performance, the S&P is up 16% year-to-date. The S&P is up just under 9%. The markets came into the, sort of the holiday weekend, quote-unquote, sort of frothy. And there's been particular attention placed on the FANG and the Fab Five names, which, quite frankly, have come under pressure from being so overbought and overhated. And those guys carry a lot of weight in the major indices. So as people look to that group as a source of funds to diversify portfolios a little bit, it's not really surprising that the markets could churn here. I mean, you had mentioned the S&P. You're absolutely right. If you look a little bit underneath the surface of that, the Russell 2000 small and mid caps have actually been churning sideways quite a bit longer. Small cap, mid cap managers have actually had a very tough year this year, with the Russell 2000, I think, being only up 2-3% year to date. So it's still very much this year a large cap story, with a lot of that Fab Five or the broad tech space, the internet space, doing much of the heavy lifting. And I think what we see going forward is more sector rotation. Quite frankly, the sentiment that I'm getting from the institutional side, at least, is that they want to continue to look to that overbought tech space. And it's really not just FANG or Fab 5, but if you look at semiconductors in particular, has been a huge market leader and was very sort of frothy. And they're starting to fan out away from that group, again, using it as a bit of source of funds. I wouldn't be surprised to see broad tech semis in the internet space continue to sort of chop sideways as rotation leads money flow into some of the, you know, recently more laggard groups. I mean, you look at something like the banks and financials that got a boost, number one, on the passage of the FCA, but also a reversal at the long end of the curve with the 10-year note yield. I think financials actually going forward are going to do a little bit more of the heavy lifting within the tape here. And that's a group that really is still under-owned, certainly not, in my opinion, overvalued. And with the bump up at the long end of the curve, I think could receive a boost in terms of investment flow. You know, biotech and healthcare is another area. Biotech recently broke out, and I realize that there's, you know, some sort of, you know, scuttlebutt surrounding, you know, Trump comments revolving around pricing of the industry. But even if you take that away, that group has been basing for quite some time. It looks to me like biotech has been under accumulation. If you look at things like the BTK index or the NBI index, these are broad gauges of biotechnology space. They've recently broken out and actually are leading the tape, you know, once again today. So, you know, it seems to me that as we take this pause in the markets, you know, the question I ask is you know, is this a market top? Is this the end of the secular bull market? Or could it be perhaps a brief pause and possibly a changing of the guards again as investors start to look to some other areas outside of technology? I think it's the latter. You know, valuation doesn't support this being a secular market top, in my opinion. I think the markets are a little bit overbought, but when we compare this to what they looked like, say, in 2007 or 2000, right, or even prior to the 87 crash, I mean, you're nowhere near those types of levels of frothiness or you know, or overbought or extended type of levels. And the other thing we would just look at is Main Street sentiment. You know, this is still very much an institutional story. Main Street is, to a great extent, uninvolved and really not paying close attention to the markets, at least not in the way they used to in prior cycles. So I don't view the markets even sort of at the S&P, you know, at 24.30, 24.50, wherever it's trading at, I don't necessarily see it as a crowded trade the way we've seen it crowded in past cycles. And so to me, you know, any pause here, any correction, even if you get a flash crash, that gives us a 10% or the 10%, by the way, brings about around 2,200 on the S&P. But you could have those corrections. We certainly always have those corrections in these sort of broad secular bull markets, but we don't see it as the end of the cycle. We don't see it as the top. More so, I believe, a changing of the guard going forward, Jim.
Okay, there's two things that I want to bring up. Usually as you get towards the end of a secular cycle and the market is peaking, you get what we call the advance of the generals and the troops are left behind. You mentioned that in this case, that would be the small caps, the mid caps, which have been struggling all year. And as you mentioned, this is largely a large cap story. So you typically get that towards the peak of a cycle. Now, the other thing you always get towards the peak of the cycle is the little guy gets over-enthused and he's jumping. He's all in at this point. We haven't seen that with one exception, Dan. I'd like to get your thoughts on it. And that is this idea of passive investing in all this money that's going into index funds, which in many ways is driving the FANG stocks.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, a couple of things. So first off, in terms of large cap, small cap, the debate of, you know, the generals leading the troops, and we've done studies on this, and this is what we found. On a relative basis, small caps tend to lead during structural bear market cycles. They tend to lead in cyclical upswings when we have sort of this multiple contraction cycle in broad bear markets. If you actually look at the 1982 to 2000 secular bull market, large caps led for a clear majority of that cycle. I'm talking probably 65% of the time. That was a large cap story. So You know, what we tend to look at, instead of who's leading who, is more so just breadth and participation. And that, you know, and you and I have talked about this in the past, I tend to focus on something like the NYSE cumulative advance decline line. And what that tells me is as the S&P makes new all-time highs, as long as other benchmarks are following suit, they don't have to necessarily be leading. But as long as they're not diverging away, making lower highs or lower lows, as something like the S&P or the large caps, you know, are making these new highs, then we have full breadth, full participation, and the market advance is healthy. And I think one of the best gauges of that is the NYSE cumulative advance decline line. And, you know, quite frankly, that indicator still appears to be in good shape, even with the new highs we made in the Dow and the S&P over the last, you know, 1 or 2 weeks, even though they were brief. They were met by new highs in breadth and participation, as evidenced by the NYSE decline line. So it's not so much a function of large cap leading small. If you remember 2014, and I think even 2013 were horrible years for small caps. They went sideways, and again, it was a large cap story. It wasn't the end of the bull market, and everybody went on to make new highs after that. So that's not so much a concern. It's if, you know, breadth and participation really start pulling away, and you just have only large caps and say only the FANG stocks, you know, making new highs, and everybody else is falling off, making lower highs or making lower lows. That's when I think we would have the bigger problem yet. So to me, the story of the tape, the story of the technicals is still one of sort of being overbought on a short-term basis, but not really looking like there's major divergence. To your second point of passive, you know, investing, this is again something we saw as well when you had the advent of 401k back in the late 1970s was the first sort of taste of investor pools for Main Street, you know, sans 1930s and pre-stock market crash, roaring 20s. But that really drove a passive landscape through most of the late 80s, early 90s, until you saw the breakaway from the tech bubble. So I don't necessarily feel that it's anything new. In fact, secular bull market cycles, and we've had one 82 to 2000, we had one 46 to 1966, we had one 1918, 1929. Those were all considered more passive cycles where it was sort of a rising tide and the basket sort of won. I see this very much similar to that. So Main Street is, you know, when I say Main Street is not involved necessarily in this market, again, it's to, and to your point, they are more passive. They sort of have a second derivative foot in or toe in the water here through a lot of their 401k investments, their pension plans, and through these passive investment strategies. But the fervor of stock trading is certainly not what it was. And I'm not certain that this sort of passive investment sort of landscape and the ennui that we're seeing in terms of investor interest from Main Street is really telling us it's the end of the cycle. I mean, if anything, you know, we're not seeing any kind of greed out there, even with the level of investor flow into a lot of those passive investments. And the only thing I would point out to that effect, too, in terms of this passive investment environment, is I wouldn't be shocked to see this continue in you know, on this trajectory and with this trend for several years more. I mean, one thing that we're starting to see is investor flow from the millennials, and they're actually providing a big boost to the passive investment sort of landscape or the passive investor strategy. And that's millennials are still building their net worth. You know, right now they have about $200 billion in annual discretionary dollars that they're generating. Over their lifetime globally, that number is going to reach around $10 trillion. And they're really now just starting to court Wall Street because they're young. I mean, the U.S. millennials are still heading towards household and family formation. We're not really hitting the peaks yet. They're getting ingrained into the workforce, and they're not at their peak earnings years. They're not at their peak consumption years. They're not even at their peak production years. But what they are starting to do is open up their Schwab accounts, open up their TD Ameritrade accounts, and we're finding that this group is very fiscally conservative, and they are choosing the passive sort of investment strategy as opposed to, you know, individual stock trading like we saw in the 80s and 90s. So, yes, you have higher levels of this sort of passive landscape, passive investment strategy, but don't forget, a lot of it is being driven by new demographics, and that, to me, suggests sustainability for probably through the next decade. So, again, I don't necessarily see that as euphoria with that strategy. If anything, I see it as we're at the early stages of it.
I want to turn to another market, and that is the 10-year Treasury market. The yields are backing up this week. We're back up over 2.3%, but we've been in this sort of narrow range between 2.1 to a little over 2.3, 2.4 in that range. Do you see that pattern continuing even now, as it looks like European yields are starting to back up, and it seems like other central banks seem to be saying that they are going to start tapering, much as the Fed did in 2014?
Sure. The yield landscape is complex. That's the easy way out of this. But the truth is, I look at this from a long-term cycle perspective. So there's stock market cycles, there's commodity market cycles, and there is a well-defined interest rate cycle in the U.S. And I do believe that we are bottoming. I mean, the interest rate cycle, in my opinion, first bottomed back in July of 2012 and then was sort of retested at the lows on the 10-year, probably in late July of last year. And so, you know, even though that range you mentioned, Jim, is kind of tight, you know, over the last 3 or 4 years, we have been building a base in long rates. They've actually been moving sideways against an expanding multiple and declining commodity prices. And also kind of what that masks is what the short end of the curve has been doing. And that's the short end has been rallying since 2013. So we are seeing reflationary pressure at the short end of the curve. We are seeing reflationary pressures in wages. We are seeing a tighter labor market here in the U.S., certainly in that, I think, lends itself to my thesis, which is we are in a reflationary expansion cycle here in the U.S. The issue with the long end of the curve is that against that tightening, that those reflationary, you know, economic pressures and that rallying multiple in equities as a discounting mechanism of this economic expansion, against that backdrop, we have a global aging demographic that has basically natural demand for fixed income product. As any investor ages, obviously risk tolerance decreases. And so as the baby boomers move toward retirement and as the global population ages, I think we're just going to see natural demand for spread product. And so that could be one of the things that's keeping that long end so stubborn. When you have that sort of natural organic demand for bonds and for fixed income, and then you could pepper in from time to time sovereign demand. So you have China recently renewing its U.S. Treasury buying program just to, you know, sop up some of its excess cash reserves. That could be a pretty powerful force, and that's really what I think is keeping long rates suppressed. I mean, your question is, you know, what's the end game to this? I mean, ultimately, I do think yields at the long end are going to break out. I mean, I'm effectively looking for 250 on the 10-year. You mentioned it's trading around 230 right now. 250 to me, 2.5% on the 10-year note yield would be a significant breakout. And I think if we saw that, you know, in the third or fourth quarter of 17, you could go well north of 3% on the 10-year. And now we have yields rising across the board to sort of complete that reflationary cycle. Question always, you know, I get after, I would suggest something like that, that yields at the long end can break out is, can you have economic expansion? Can you have multiple expansion in a rising rate environment? And my answer to that is, if you look at history as a guide, you absolutely can. It is a possibility. It's not a certainty. Nothing in life is, but it's certainly a possibility if there's an oxymoron in that somewhere. But again, you know, and what we're looking at here is growing demographics, a growing economy greater than 2 to 3% GDP per annum. We're seeing wage inflation. We're seeing a tighter labor market. And you're seeing a multiple on the S&P for trailing 12 is still, I think, around 20, where the end of these cycles, typically it's in the low 30s, if not higher. So I do believe that eventually the long end of the curve is going to break out. We're not looking for any type of stagflationary or hyperinflationary spiral, but we do think that their progression is going to be upwards in the years ahead, and that you are going to be able to sustain a stocks bull market, at least in the U.S., against that backdrop. So we continue to urge our investors to stay long equities, you know, relative to bonds, specifically treasuries, as well as commodities at this point.
And speaking of commodities, we've seen some weakness in the dollar, and especially now that yields have been backing up in Europe and elsewhere. Why have we not seen, with the exception of maybe oil here recently, which is moving its way back up, at least WTI is, what about commodities here? And specifically, let's talk about gold, base metals, and oil.
Yeah, sure. So there's, you know, a couple of different things of how these commodities are used. I mean, if you want to see a couple of hyperinflationary spirals taking place right now, call up the daily charts of wheat prices, I believe corn prices, soybean. Wheat has been absolutely ripping. It's had a parabolic move over the last few days. So we are finally, after years of depressed sort of ag commodity prices, we're starting to see serious reversals in that space. In terms of crude oil prices, crude oil had become deeply oversold over the last several months and effectively saw mean reversion, which is just oversold counter trend rallies due to severe technical pressures. I mean, nothing had changed drastically in the supply, you know, part of the equation, or even the global demand part of the equation. It was really more a trading phenomenon. Now that oil is trading between $46, $48 a barrel and has relieved a lot of those oversold pressures, I would suspect we're going to stay more in a range there, obviously, unless we see any kind of geopolitical disruption. In terms of gold prices, you know, gold prices very much used as a hedge against, you know, sort of declining economic or financial market conditions. And what we see here is, you know, even though there's reflation in the system, you know, we're starting to see some wage pressures, some reflationary pressures in the economy. The long end of the curve, as I said, remains stubborn. And so gold is not taking any cues as to we're headed for any type of severe inflationary pressures on the system. And so gold really remains underweight and underutilized because we're still in the growth phase. This is a reflation and not an inflation. So what we've typically found is a negative correlation between multiple cycles, the equity multiple cycle, PE, you know, and commodity prices. The two are sort of counterweights to one another. When you are in a multiple expansion cycle, it tends to see all the money flow gravitate back towards equities and away from the commodity markets. And so typically, if you're in a secular bull market in equities, we will see a secular bear market, which equates to a trading range in most commodities. And that's absolutely what we have seen, and I think that's what we're going to continue to see. So again, you know, oil to me was a function of just severe oversold pressures on a short-term basis. Ag, I had mentioned, had been depressed for a few years and is just spiking now due to oversold pressures. And again, gold remains out of favor because even though we're seeing reflation and even though they're talking and we're looking at rates bumping up, there's no signs of any major inflation or stagflationary pressures that would suppress the multiple expansion cycle or would suppress economic growth at this point. I mean, to me, it's still very much a Goldilocks scenario in terms of how the U.S. is growing, believe it or not, even though it doesn't feel like it from a sentiment perspective. Most of the numbers are good and are not overheated. And I think that's keeping investors away from gold as that hedge, you know, against market volatility and downturn. You know, we looked at the 210 spread to look for cues in terms of any type of recession, you know, coming up. And based on the analysis that we're doing here, the odds of a recession don't even come into play until the end of 2019, early 2020 at this point. I mean, that's sort of where the yield spreads are and where the curve is at this point. So there's no need for investors to gravitate towards gold because there's no real inherent secular risk. I think the biggest risk to the markets now would be some type of short-term, you know, geopolitical instability. And it's the first time really I've said that and seen that. I mean, in the past, we've worried about the credit markets. Are they functioning properly? Is there ample demand? In the past, we've worried about valuation. You know, is it overheated? We've worried about investor sentiment. Is it too frothy? Is it too much of a crowded trade? You know, we've worried about a host of things, and all those things in terms of our dashboard seem to be generally healthy. And against that backdrop, we see the breadth of the tape as generally healthy and supportive of the advance. So the only thing I could see is sort of disrupting this over the short run would be some type of, I hate to use the word black swan, but some type of geopolitical event that may disrupt things and cause a spike in volatility. I myself, if we do see that, again, depending on what it is, nobody can predict the future. But I do believe that on any repricing of these markets, the institutional community, at the very least, they're looking to put a lot of money to work on pullbacks here. So even in the case of a geopolitical disruption or a disruptor event, I think the market is heavily supported here, even on corrections.
So given all of this, if you had money to put to work, what would you do with it?
Well, I would put it in U.S. equities. I'd put it in something like the S&P 500. In my opinion, I don't think I would chase after the FANG names. I realize everybody loves Amazon and they're, you know, expected to rule the world someday. However, that to me is a crowded trade in terms of institutional and retail involvement. So in my mind, I would look to the healthcare space. I would look towards biotechnology. And quite frankly, I would look towards the banks and financials. I mean, this is a group that I've looked to in the past. And, you know, from a valuation perspective, they're still relatively cheap. I know from an exposure perspective, the street is still, you know, underexposed to them. I mean, they're under-owned, in my opinion. And I know that with a bump up in rates at the long end, if we get in, if the 10-year breaks above 2.5%, a lot of these guys are going to be printing money. So this is a group that, don't forget, still makes up 13-14% of the S&P 500 and has lagged behind. I mean, they're flat on the year relative to the S&P. Maybe they're up slightly now, but I think this is a group that has been underestimated. So I would look towards the banks, and as always, I would continue to look to healthcare and biotech as sort of the new technology and the growth space that could be a market driver. So, yeah, Jim, I would put it in equities. I mean, even sort of at these levels, I know people tend to look at the price of the stock market or the level of the stock market on a nominal basis, but you always have to look at it in conjunction with valuation. And only when valuation has reached extremes and price is at extremes do we see those major market tops. Typically, if the price is making new highs, but valuation is still coming off lower, is in an uptrend and has not yet reached extremes, there's probably still more miles to travel on the upside. And quite frankly, I think that's where we are. I would agree consensus is right now we're due a correction. I wouldn't be surprised. But again, I think something like that would be temporary on the way to even higher levels.
All right. Well, listen, Dan, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they can easily do so.
Well, we're at Janney in Philadelphia. The best thing to do, I would suppose, is shoot me an email. My email address is dwantrobski. It's dwantrobski at janney.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
Here's a reminder that if you're not listening to the daily Financial Sense News Hour, you're really missing a lot. Let me show you.
A recent Bloomberg article notes that U.S. consumer spending on pleasure boats, aircraft, and other RVs is booming, just clocking in the fastest pace of growth in 13 years. Joining us on the show is Kurt Kaluse at ExecSpec. And Kurt, I'm starting to feel like I'm missing out. Have you bought your RV or your boat yet?
No, but I was thinking about putting a bid on a yacht soon. No, I do feel guilty as well that I have not taken part in that. And when my wife hears this interview, I think she might start booking the flights right now for some cruise in the Caribbean somewhere. So it doesn't surprise me too much to hear about that, given the optimism that we're seeing in the consumer sentiment surveys and the record income levels that are being achieved and very low unemployment levels. So it seems to fit very well with the aging demographics out there and the excess money that is being accumulated with the very low debt level.
Well, since the beginning of the year, we've seen the dollar decline. Gold has gone up a bit. It's up 7% for the year, but it has not rallied as much as the dollar has fallen. With the economy doing well, why is the dollar going down? Joining me on the program is Mark Chandler. He's author of a new book called Political Economy of Tomorrow, and he joins us from Brown Brothers Harriman. Mark, let's begin with the dollar. We had a nice rally into the end of the year, and then as the market started to rally, expecting great things out of the administration, the dollar has come down. What is causing the dollar to weaken?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time thinking about this because I too thought the dollar was going to get stronger this year. I think that a couple of factors have taken a toll. One is the unwinding of sort of the so-called Trump trade. I think that what's happened with the healthcare reform has made people question the legislative prowess of the administration for tax reform, for infrastructure, and as well as for the broader deregulation. And so that's one thing. But secondly, and this is really what's going on right now, Jim, is that there seems to be like a mini paper tantrum taking place in Europe where the ECB is understood by many people in the market to be signaling that the sort of peak QE is behind it. And so with this, for example, just today, the German 10-year Bund yield is above 50 basis points, which had really marked the top end of the range for the past 18 months or so. And so European interest rates are rising faster. They expect, that is, the market expects a shift in ECB policy, but is not convinced that Yellen and the Federal Reserve can raise interest rates while the economy is soft. And as you know, that core measures of inflation have declined the past 4 months.
You know, I was looking at the futures market, Mark, and they're still expecting a 50% chance that the Fed will go one more time, most likely in December. That is down considerably from the high 60s. Is there a possibility, in your estimation, and this has been so difficult to gauge, that the Fed maybe pulls back a little bit, but, you know, in the latest minutes, they're still talking about shrinking their balance sheet, which is another form of tightening?
Yeah, and that's another scenario that I think that is the most likely scenario going forward, is nothing happens in July. The Federal Reserve watching the economy in September, both I think the ECB and the Federal Reserve tweak their policies. In September, I expect the Federal Reserve to announce that it will begin its effort to reduce its balance sheet starting in October. So it'd be October, November, December. And so by the end of the year, the Federal Reserve's balance sheet will shrink by roughly $30 billion, which I think is really inconsequential as far as the real monetary impact. And I think in September, the Federal Reserve will not raise the Fed funds target rate like many people expect, but instead wait until December, by which time I do expect the economy to look a bit better and for some modest price pressures to continue to go up. And so with that in mind, I think the Federal Reserve has shifted from a place where they were, say, a year ago, waiting for the economic data to suggest that the economy is strong. And now I think they're viewing the economy as fairly resilient, wanting to look past short-run noisy things, they say, and focus on the signal. And the signal is a fairly resilient U.S. economy.
So, Mark, one of the things that surprised the market is a speech that Yellen gave last week where she made reference that she doubts, given the stress test of the banks, that we would ever see a financial crisis like we did between 2007 and 2009. You know, a lot of times Fed chairmen are known for making these kind of statements. I think of Bernanke in 2007 that said housing was in great shape. So, you know, if you take a look at a lot of these crises that we've had over the last couple decades, many of them were brought about by Fed policy and they completely missed it. So, what do you think of that comment? And do you buy her argument that the banks are so strong now that we're unlikely to see another financial crisis?
Well, I do think that there is something to this idea that, I guess it depends on what you mean by crisis. But I do think that we had the Great Depression, and about 45 years before the Great Depression, 1890s, another major financial crisis. And so I think there is something that's intriguing about the 50-year, 40-year waves, like Kondratiev waves as well, big cycle in our political economy. So I think that what she was saying was that really that this is a, like the 100-year flood. You're saying that there's not going to be another 100-year flood since we just had one. I think it makes sense, even if we want to believe that, have hope in that, that still makes sense to have prudent, financial management, risk management of our savings and of our investments. So I think we could talk about how many angels dance on the head of a pin, but I think it doesn't really change the matters at the end of the day, that who knows if there's going to be another crisis. We hope the banking system is sound enough and that regulators like the Federal Reserve have put a lot of things to help banks as well as to protect taxpayers. I'm not convinced that that's going to be the case, in the sense that it seems to me that capitalism is prone to these financial crises. Think about what banks do. They borrow in the short term and lend in the long term. And I just think that that's prone to having crises, and which is very unique to capitalism. There were other types of problems, of course, before capitalism. But the idea of financial crises seems to be very much endemic to capitalism itself. No?
Absolutely. I want to talk about what's going on with growth. It seems to be picking up, at least in Europe, it's picking up. Our growth rate is still going strong, although this recovery is getting long in the tooth. The question I have, Mark, will the Fed be able to, they're talking about normalizing monetary policy, given the level of debt that is out there today, $20 trillion at the federal level, we have corporate debt, we have consumer debt. It all looks good now because asset values have risen on real estate, so everything looks better. Will they be able to normalize and get rates back to, let's say, where they were before the crisis when the Fed funds rate was at 5%? I mean, we're at 1.25% right now. Getting it up to 5%, I mean, that's a steep climb.
Yeah, I kind of think we should expect, this is, I talk about this in my new book, that essentially the problem with money and why I don't think we'll get interest rates back like that level again for quite some time is that money is like other commodities. What I mean by that is we know what happened. We thought that there's too much oil. We as investors thought that there's too much oil in the market relative to demand, and so the price fell. And you can see this, there's a drought in the United States, and that's helping to push up wheat prices and grain prices, for example, right now. The same thing with money. The reason the interest rates are so low is not simply because central banks like the Federal Reserve and the ECB have been buying bonds, but yields are low because inflation is low, because growth is low, because there's too much money. Interest rates are like to measure the price of money, and the low price of money suggests that there's ample supply of it. And so what this means, I think, then, is that in this business cycle, we should be lucky if the Federal Reserve can get Fed funds up to 2 to 2.5%, basically bringing the Fed funds rate back to the rate of inflation. And the 10-year, you see what's happening. When the Federal Reserve raised rates in March and last December, the 10-year yield was around 260. We have fallen in that 10-year yield despite these Fed hikes. We fell to about 215. Instead of, say, third week in June or so, maybe a little bit lower. Now we're back up 237, nearing 240. It's better. The higher yield, I think, shows a more positive outlook for events, but it's also because the ECB and that mini taper tantrum that we talked about.
So Europe has gone through sort of mini taper tantrum where you've seen German bund yields almost double. I want to talk about the price of gold. Typically, Mark, when you see the dollar fall as it has since the beginning of the year, gold has a good year. Now it's up 7%, but certainly nowhere near what the dollar has come down. Why do you think gold has not been responding this time around as much as it normally does when the dollar falls?
Yeah, no, you raise a good point. It matters how you want to measure the dollar. I was looking at it on a trade-weighted basis. It's fallen about 8%, 8.5%. I'd say gold's lag is maybe not so big. But on the other hand, I'd say what's going on here is that when interest rates are very low, and, you know, we still have something like $7 or $8 trillion worth of bonds in Europe and Japan with negative yields. But when interest rates are low, the opportunity cost of holding gold, which, remember, is a non-interest-bearing security, or non-interest-bearing asset, the opportunity cost of holding gold, basically what a T-bill would yield, inconsequential. But interest rates are rising, and the opportunity cost for holding gold has gone up. And so I think that that might help explain why people are preferring higher-yielding assets right now to gold.
All right, let's take a look at some of the other commodities. If you're looking at the grains, grains were on fire this year, especially wheat. But the other commodity sectors outside of base metals have been weak. But you've got ags rising and base metals. What does that tell you?
Yeah, and I usually think about ags. I mean, I don't study them very closely, but I usually think of them as sort of weather markets. And like I say, we have a drought in the U.S. that pushing up grain prices. And of course, the industrial metals, I think these days, is for the most part a function of what's going on in China. You think about really, I think this is lost on a lot of people. You think about what the U.S. produces, and it's amazing what a large part of our GDP, what it means to be service economy, means that less manufacturing. Less manufacturing means less need for resources, those natural resources. So, I mean, I'd say that the interesting thing to me in the commodity space right now is what's going on with steel. The Trump administration is reportedly considering, after investigating in the Commerce Department, putting tariffs, maybe a combination of tariffs and quotas, on steel imports. And, of course, this is one of those factors that have helped steel companies, people anticipate, sort of a windfall to them.
So, given that, there was a couple other comments that was made both by European central bankers and our own central bank that asset prices have gotten somewhat elevated, and they're always worried about asset bubbles being formed, especially with low interest rates and speculation coming into the market through leverage. What's your view of that point, given where the markets are right now? Margin debt is up there, and, you know, we've seen tremendous valuations in what we call the FANG stocks, whether you're looking at Facebook, Amazon. Some of these valuations are Netflix, when you're selling at 200 times earnings, are certainly considered elevated.
And I think you're right, Jimmy. It's a very important point, I think, that also is often misunderstood. Most people talk about the Federal Reserve as having a dual mandate, full employment and price stability. But in fact, I think that you hit on really the Fed's third mandate that people often overlook, and that's financial stability. So here's how I would think of it. In recent weeks, there's been a pushback against the Federal Reserve, the June rate hike. Despite being criticized, many people criticizing the Federal Reserve for being too dovish for the past couple of years, somehow the June rate hike and the talk about shrinking its balance sheet somehow has gotten a lot of people in the market thinking the Fed is being too hawkish now. And so the Federal Reserve, and partly to articulate its case, we've seen the leadership, Yellen, Fisher, and Dudley, as well as a couple of regional presidents, add to their argument in favor of continuing the gradual normalization of policy by talking about financial conditions and how the financial conditions are easier now than when the Federal Reserve began raising interest rates. And this is partly because I suggest there's a lag time between the time monetary policymakers make a decision and for this to work its way through the economy. We saw this during the crisis, early days of the crisis. The Fed is easing aggressively, but the economy is still weakening. Unemployment levels are still going up. And now, kind of the opposite, the Fed's trying to tap on the brake ever so gradually, ever so slightly, and it's not having much of an impact yet. And so they get impatient. And there's a temptation to use this as part of the argument why they have to continue to normalize policy.
So, Mark, in the past, the Fed has not had a good reputation of bringing the plane down to a safe landing. They tend to crash the plane. What is the risk that they overdo at this time, that in an effort to try to normalize policy, now you start throwing in, I mean, $30 billion is shrinking their balance sheet on a $4.6 trillion balance sheet is nothing. It's peanuts. But what is the risk that the combination of the two, shrinking the balance sheet, because they said every quarter they would raise from $10 billion to $20 billion to eventually $30 billion a month, what is the risk that they overdo at this time?
Yeah, you know, it's always a possibility. I wonder, though, if that's kind of ironic in a way, what I want to say here, but it seems to me that you've got all the hallmarks, again, of that period of time between roughly, say, the mid-1980s to roughly 2000, 15 years, give or take a little bit. I'd say we had what a lot of economists might call the Great Moderation, where we had long business cycle that had sort of long duration, smaller amplitude, not a very strong booms, very shallow downturns. And so I kind of think that we have a possibility of still being in the sweet spot. And I say that possibility despite the great financial crisis, that the great moderation might be strong enough. Those forces that are lengthening the business cycle, things like better inventory management, like regulation, lengthening the business cycle to avoid excesses. And that's the point I'd say, really. How do we get business cycles? Well, partly during the boom period, excesses are created. So those excesses have to be absorbed, and that's absorbed in the downside of a cycle. And so what impresses me about this business cycle is there does not seem to be a large imbalance I hear you about valuation of stock market and financial assets, but it seems to me that those are slowly coming back to earth in terms of valuation. Earnings are catching up. Not all stocks are rallying, of course. And so if you really look below the surface, I think you see a different, more discerning picture, as well as I think that it takes some time that the business cycle itself might have been improved, not through necessarily through the management at the Federal Reserve level.
So, Mark, given what you see right now, what would you be doing as an investor?
Frankly, I'm just sitting tight right now. I'm concerned that what's going to happen in the rest of this month, July and August, is really going to be setting the stage for September. You know, not only will we have a very important FOMC meeting, a very important ECB meeting, but Congress will come back from their recess, and they have a couple of big things on the agenda that they have to do, including the debt ceiling, raising the debt ceiling, and next year's budget spending authorization. So we could be in some serious trouble as Europe and other countries seem to be moving ahead. For example, just today, the Japanese and the EU agreed on a political level that we have a trade agreement, a free trade agreement between the EU and Japan. And the U.S. has a free trade agreement with neither one of them. So I think we've got a lot of work ahead of us. And so for me, I just want to sit and wait my time. I think that at Brown Brothers, the one big lesson I have learned as an investor is about value. And I know that given the stock market rise and exactly what the Federal Reserve officials are talking about, how stretched valuation is, I'm happy to build up cash waiting for an opportunity.
Well, listen, Mark, as we close, you want to tell our listeners about your new book, The Political Economy of Tomorrow.
It's available on Amazon. It's a book that basically tries to suggest that the problems that we have with capitalism is too much of money, which is why I suggested in our discussion here. I think of it as like a King Midas, a modern King Midas narrative about what's going on in the world economy. Remember King Midas from Greek mythology? Whatever he touched turned to gold and seemed nice in the beginning until he wanted to eat and hug his daughter. And so I think that it's an interesting book. It was fun to write. And it's also tried to give a big picture sense of what's going on in the world in a sort of maybe non-consensus way. So Political Economy of Tomorrow.
And if they would like to contact you or follow your work, how can they do so?
So I'm on Twitter at Mark Making Sense. That's Mark with a C. And my blog is called Mark to Market. Mark with a C, and then Mark Making Sense is my Twitter handle.
Next week, Fed Chair Janet Yellen will be on Capitol Hill for her semi-annual testimony. So the markets are going to be focused on whether or not the Fed will be consistent as far as what they have announced they're doing on interest rates and their balance sheet. You have to recognize this market that has gone up for the last 9 years has been driven almost exclusively by central bank policy, not by economic fundamentals or other considerations that have driven markets skyward in the past. So then the question is the big bull market about to be over? And if we're out on the dance floor with stocks, is it about time to slide over toward the exit and hope that nobody else notices? Speaking of the year and predictions, which the Fed, by the way, almost always gets wrong in its predictions, which I guess should tell us something. The year's turning out much more differently than expected. Oil was expected to go up. Rates were expected to go up. The dollar was expected to go up. They didn't go up. And the market's doing pretty well. So what has the market been drinking? Because overall, it's been a pretty good year. And we'll tag onto that, the bond market as well. All of that coming up next as part of The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues, like it always does, at financialsense.com.